Ladies and gentlemen, it's my privilege and pleasure to welcome to the Salieri Report Harry Blaser. Harry is so important to me and to the Salieri team that I asked him, in fact, to record a more detailed bio introduction, which is going to be at your subscriber links. Harry is my go-to person for food. He has an extraordinary background. He built the largest fresh food market in the country, Harry's Farmers Market in Atlanta, and then sold it to Whole Foods and was living at his ranch in Montana. And in 2005, asked me to come up to Montana and work with him to develop a financing structure for a local food system. And what began was a project where I taught Harry about the real deal and Harry taught me about food. And it was a quite interesting and tumultuous and one of the most intellectually demanding and interesting periods of my life. Harry has been gallivanting around the globe and doing very fascinating consulting to the top grocers around the world. And I've tried for many years to get him on the Salieri Report, and he's finally said yes, and not only yes, but he's going to be leading us in a series on food, because food is at the heart of the global economy, and I think is only going to get more and more important for reasons that Harry and I will talk to. So it is with great pleasure that I both introduce the Salieri series on food and introduce you to someone who knows more about food than anyone you will ever find on the whole planet. Harry Blaser, welcome to the Salieri Report, Harry.
I don't know if that's exactly true, but I have a big network of people that probably combined have a tremendous amount of insight and understanding about food. But I know a fair amount about retailing and merchandising and supply chain and stuff like that. But thank you very, very much for that compliment. By the same token, there's nobody that I know of that's better to teach the world about the real deal than you. And Salieri.com is an amazing resource. It's my go-to resource also for insights into just about everything having to do with life.
Well, you and I are known to, either by phone or by email, be calling each other from all corners of the planet saying, "What do you think that is?" So,
yeah,
the reason
matter of fact, the whole Montana thing started out once we got together as kind of an extension of the whole Salieri Circle idea. We wanted to create a Salieri Circle for people that were interested in creating a sustainable food system within, you know, Northwest Montana. So your guiding principles, coming clean, you name it. I mean, all the major points that you have and the secret, of course, to coming clean being shutting off your TV, banking local, and eating fresh, has proven itself over time. And, you've done a great job of elaborating on that and going into great detail, and now we have the opportunity to do that with food a little bit.
So the reason I say that you understand food better than anybody on the planet is I think to understand food, you have to understand the governance and management systems planet-wide and how they relate to control and how food relates to that. And if you're going to understand food on planet Earth, you really need to understand the big picture and the models by which the economies are managed. And it's rare you find somebody who's expert at food who's taken the time to learn that, and you have. So why don't we just dive in and start with sort of planetary models? Because I think food is going to become more and more important. Maybe we could talk about I see, it's wonderful in the little Just a Taste we put up. You describe that there are two models of sort of governance on planet Earth. One is pro-centralization, one is pro-decentralization. But maybe if you could describe the picture of food in the two models and why I say there's sort of two approaches at the macro level to food on planet Earth.
Catherine, when you talk about the seminal events or legislation, you might say, a regulation that has changed the 20th century. You know, one of the key events, and for example, corporations being given human rights. One of the key is being able to patent life. That is fairly recent, whether it's in the last 20 or 25 years, between the Patent Office and the Supreme Court basically providing that right. Well, that right basically opened up the biotech industry and for people to go after creating life, synthesizing life now that they could own. But that mentality actually started with the Green Revolution, because that was hybrid seed-based, which became intellectual property. But not only that, you know, there are basically three kinds of seeds in the world today. One is open pollination, and you could think of that as free sex. The other is hybrid, which you could think of as an arranged marriage. So it's getting species together and carefully controlling the environment so that you get them to fertilize each other. So out of that comes a nectarine or a pluot, you know, a combination of a plum and an apricot. So it's stone fruit. It's the same species, but something that you'd have to have just the right circumstances for it to happen. But now you have these hybrid seeds that can't be saved. So when you have open pollination seeds, the way that nature has been doing it for many, many, many millennium, you know, you end up with seeds, if you're somewhat careful, that are able to bring the same plant back after you plant them. You don't have to rely on anyone else. You can save them, plant them, and you're going to get pretty much the same thing that you had the season before. Hybrid seeds, as they're known as F1 or first-generation seeds, following Mendel's and Darwin's suggestions about interbreeding and how genetics works, you end up with a seed that is very different if you tried to save it and plant it the second generation. So a whole industry has built up around keeping hybrid seeds fresh, you might say. And Holland, of course, is recognized in the world as one of the best at this and the most sophisticated at it. So, but now you've got something that is controlled by a corporation. You can't save seeds. And when a lot of these seed companies are also involved with chemicals and chemical production and the sale of chemicals, and oftentimes get a lot of their profits from that, now they develop hybrid seeds that require more fertilization, more chemical inputs to make them work properly. And they work pretty good to begin with. Then you get hooked. And then they can charge you what they want. Genetically modified organisms are basically an extension of that same mentality. And it's a mentality of control. And, you know, these guys are not, the agricultural industry is not doing things for the benefit of the world, regardless of what the PR tells you. They are looking at extending their control. You know, almost everything automatically moves towards a monopoly if you let it. And control of the food supply in the world. That's why, for me, this whole issue about food is ultimately an issue about human freedom. And it's the last major lever we have, I think, to basically exert control over our lives.
Now, when you talk with people in the food industry, so if you talk with members of the pro-decentralization team, what you will hear is concern that they need to feed ultimately 11 billion people on the planet, they need to double the food production, and whether it's hybrid or GMO seed and chemicals, that's the way to do it. And they absolutely believe that is the way to get the production they need.
Yep, and, you know, for me, the world has become to a large extent, this challenge for the corporate world, corporatocracy, you might say. It's one of PR. It's one of marketing. It's not about a search for truth. It's about managing expectations. Because ever since Bernays, you know, let people understand that how important perception is in terms of thought and behavior, basically a huge effort's been put into managing perception.
Right.
But if you spent any time at all looking at the world, the ecology, it's something that's probably one of the key indicators and actually an incredible microcosm of life overall. It's the soil. The soil hasn't been doing real well under the tutelage
right.
of these large corporations under the guise of the Green Revolution. And so when you destroy the major substrate that is supporting life on Earth, and of course agriculture, which by the way is a pretty modern experiment, you know, within the last 10,000 years or so,
right.
And the outcome is still unknown. Okay, so in one sense, you've got corporations all around the world doing the Hegelian dialectic dance, which of course is, you know, problem, reaction, solution. So by continuing to create these problems through the methods that they're using, they're creating many additional problems that they then say they are needed to solve. So I don't agree that the Green Revolution and GMOs are the answer to solving hunger. But not only that, there's now lots of evidence that indicates it's exactly the opposite. The way to do it is to have a decentralized model of your local farmers that have tremendous understanding of their soil, a commitment to protecting that soil, seeds that are open pollinators and oftentimes heirloom seeds, which are ones that are saved, you know, very specific varieties of stuff that are saved and passed down on those open pollinators. And a key word here to any living vital system is diversity.
Right.
Basically, you've got one chicken that the chicken industry uses in the United States. You've got, you know, a handful of corn, soy, and canola, cotton, and so on that are controlled by these, you know, the genetically modified guys. And it's largely, that's basically what there is left in the United States outside of some pockets. You've destroyed, one figure I saw, 75% of the diversity that we eat in this world in the last 50 years.
Right.
So I don't know of anything that's more frightening than that. And then on top of it, you've created a situation where genetically modified pollen from these plants infects the world, the crops. So in A Scientist Under Attack, which was one of the first to really bring it to the world's attention, the scientific basis for concern about these technologies. You got this one guy who, of course, all these guys meet tremendous headwinds when they discover this stuff, who went to Mexico, kind of the birthplace of corn. I think they had 25,000 different varieties of corn. And he's measuring 1,000 miles away from where there was any known source of the genetically modified pollen, where it exists.
Right.
And it's contaminating crops.
Right.
Then on top of it, they will come back and sue you for intellectual property infringement because they've contaminated your field with
right.
their stuff. And the courts have backed them up.
Now, the U.S. courts have backed them up. Have international courts backed them up?
Well, certainly the courts in the United States have.
Right.
And, you know, we know how much of that is run by international treaties, and certainly on these new treaties, TPP and so on, that they're trying to get through. You know, they've given them a lot more. Intellectual property rights are much, much more the focus of those things, so that basically you can have an international, not only legal system, but a police system that
right.
will basically enforce these things.
Let me step back and just bring up a couple points that you've touched on. One is a matter of disclosure. I want to remind everyone that my grandfather was Dean of Social Sciences at the Rockefeller Foundation, and I was brought up being told that he'd helped finance the Green Revolution and that this was a wonderful thing, which he really believed. He really believed he had dramatically increased or helped to dramatically increase food production around the world. And thought it was a wonderful thing. And I look at it very differently now, but I look back. The only thing I can say in justification of our family tree is the Dulles brothers did get him fired because he was too supportive of decentralization, believe it or not. So it's a long family tradition. The second thing is you talk about open pollination, and we keep being reminded that the bee population is declining. What's the connection between that and what we're talking about? Because what I keep seeing is the justification that we need to do things like GMO because we can't depend on the bees. So hold that thought for a second. The other thing I wanted to bring up is one of the videos that I encourage the Salier Report subscribers to watch, try and make sure they all watch, is the interview with Sir James Goldsmith with Charlie Rose in 1994, which makes it clear that what's happening with the creation of the WTO is a plan underway to basically put 2 to 3 million small farmers out of business globally and industrialize the entire agricultural and food system. And what you're describing...
You've asked a tremendous amount of stuff. All of it is incredibly relevant. And so I'll start talking, and then I'll have to come back and say, okay, now remind me what else.
Well, I think it's fair to say that when the Uruguay Roundup got passed and the WTO went into effect, a process began where we were trying to basically centralize control of the global food system top down, and it was very clear and understood at the time that that was so.
Yeah, absolutely.
In other words, this is not market forces at work. This was a real governance plan.
I remember being on the phone trying to get some wheat at a very good price for an African country. And so I called him up. I said, you know, gee, but that's a pretty high price for this country. I mean, can't you guys do better? I know that you're selling it here and here and here. Yeah, but we just haven't decided to subsidize, you know, the price of wheat for that country at this time. And so there's, you know, there's this, I think everybody between the CIA, the NSA, the Department of Agriculture, and the FDA, they have all their cell phone numbers, you know?
Right.
So somebody's talking to each other. But you've shown and we've known for years how basically the deep state is and the intelligent networks are basically representatives of corporate America. They're out there basically, you know, finding out what the competitive pressures are, who they're up against, and feeding them the information so they can basically go to the business meeting, you know, with better intelligence than the guys across the table. So this desire for control among a small group of people that are in the club and are like-minded has been going on, you know, for way before even the American Republic came into place. And now it's enabled by, you know, a whole other level of technology and a whole other level of, you might say, emboldenment by the success that they've had. So you have an embedded control mechanism that can be pointed in lots of different directions. And when you point it, it can be very effective, especially since, you know, these guys are working basically totally undercover. They have their independent sources of financing, oftentimes illegal, oftentimes destroying the very wealth that that governments are supposed to be protecting, and you end up with a world that is shaped according to somebody's vision, and it rarely has anything to do, despite the marketing, with what's good for most of the people and most of the planet. Okay, so that's
but literally, what we're watching is an intentional effort to assert control of the global seed and food supply.
Yeah, but it's of everything.
Of everything, right.
Yeah, so if you make a list of the things you want to control, what are they? Well, you want to control money. You
right.
want to control water. You want to control food. You want to control perception. You know, it's a relatively short list. You want to control geography in a way, like you keep talking about control of the seas. You want to control space, which is basically a large sea that's outside of the planet. You know, there's a few things
right.
like that. And so that's, yeah, so that's what's where all the money is going to try to control.
Right.
Right. So if you can control food and control water, you basically have total control of people. Total. And because basically within 3 days, if you're not eating, you're not really in a very good condition to resist.
Right.
If you're not drinking water, you know, within 24 hours, you're in trouble as a biological
right.
system.
Right.
So you start out with something that looks remarkable. There are probably people, which is the Green Revolution, there are probably people that think this is the answer. And you know, as I say, to understand the real deal, you basically have to come to grips with three facts. If you don't buy into this, then this conversation needs to end, and we basically just need to go our separate ways. Evil does exist. There are people that are interested in controlling you, and they have a plan. They plan. Okay, so you don't have to look very far to get that validation, verification that those three things are happening. And now the planning mechanisms, the modeling mechanisms, the you know, computer supported and the big data supported abilities to look at the world and know more about what's going on, behaviors, is beyond what anybody could imagine. And then
right.
basically these guys can operate in the dark on top of
right.
it. And if you get in the way, they don't mind basically eliminating you in all the different ways that they have, which is ruining your reputation,
right.
you know, or suddenly you're coming down with a very weird strain of cancer, or, you
right.
know, you get your head blown off in Dealey Plaza. So sorry, guys, this is the way that the world works, and anybody that's running a large corporation understands that.
Okay, so one thing I will say, you know, when you and I first started to be in cahoots, I really believed that the effort to adopt GMO seed and food supply globally was an effort to replace oil as the basically asset standard behind a global reserve currency. And yet during the time that you and I have been in cahoots, we have seen the consumer globally absolutely reject and resist GMOs. And it's getting stronger and stronger. And we'll talk a little bit more about that. So one of the things I will say is, despite all the advantages and the force behind it, the model's getting rejected pretty resoundingly. So we're right in the middle of a real war, and it's really trench warfare globally. And I would not say that the GMO forces are winning. So we'll get into that more. But let's just turn a little bit to health, because you and I are talking now about the macro and the geopolitics of food. But at the micro level, the beauty of taking revolutionary acts with food is you get a lot more healthy. So I would say one of the advantages of the decentralized model is there's the opportunity for the people on the team to be much, much healthier. So maybe you could talk a little bit about the attractiveness of our vision to personal health.
This is a key point here. The centralization team is fueled by a concept of scarcity.
Right.
It depends for its success on basically scarcity. Whether it's human potential through through the imagination that we have by being connected in special ways with the earth that the native folks can educate us about tremendously, and indigenous people, to the incredible amount of energy that's out there, if you didn't have to be dependent on just oil and so on. So the universe is abundant beyond anything we can imagine. And part of the control mechanism is to keep us separated from the sources of that abundance. You can't synthesize a world that could potentially be more productive from an agricultural, in terms of supporting life. You can't think of it. I mean, I couldn't imagine it more than this planet. Okay, so at any place you look, you see that the agricultural processes have basically reduced that wealth, that reduced the potential for wealth in some fundamental way. And all you need to do is, like I said, take a look at the soil. Okay, so the organic movement started because basically everything was organic 100 years ago, and then the FDA and the USDA came in and basically allowed things to become adulterated. And then there was a grassroots movement for basically, can we get good food again? So then organic standards came in, so the food is less adulterated. And then you have large corporations getting involved and controlling most of that output now. Now you have a bastardization of those standards again. You have one of the major ethics behind organic was taking care of the soil. Now you have large organic farms that oftentimes are using a lot of the same practices that end up debilitating soil. So, so basically, if you think that you can rely on the USDA, FDA, EPA, NSA, CIA, these guys to be looking out for your benefit, you're wrong. So you better figure it out for yourself.
Right.
And what I found in the supermarket industry is if any one of you guys could sincerely, with the right intention and authentically partner with your customers in terms of their welfare and bring that intentionality all the way back to the supply chain, you would have a differentiated competitive advantage that would be absolutely unmatched. And anybody that's doing a half-assed job of it, whether it's Whole Foods or Chipotle and so on, that are half pregnant in a lot of ways and sometimes part of the problem, they, are extremely successful. Okay,
right.
So it's very clear, when the supermarket, when I go to these people and say you can't be on the side of GMOs, you're back in the wrong team, guys, and the organizations that are coming from supporting the supermarket industry, like Groceries Association and all these guys, that are supporting no labeling. I say you're on the wrong side of this thing, guys. It's going to backfire in your face. So they say, yeah, but the people, we do our surveys, and the people don't really, GMOs is not that big a deal for people. Wait a minute, guys. You're not asking the right questions. If you asked somebody and said, would you like your food to be contaminated, and basically you being used as a guinea pig, would you be okay with that? Because that's basically what happened.
But let me explain the war. As I know you certainly know it, but let me explain for the listeners the war. I was out in California and shopping at a Whole Foods in Palo Alto, where when I'm staying in Palo Alto, I sometimes shop. And Whole Foods just made an announcement vis-a-vis GMOs that was, supportive of the customer and recognizing they didn't want GMOs. So I think it was about labeling. The big labeling referendum was on in California. So Whole Foods had come out and said something anti-GMO like. And so the next day I'm in Whole Foods shopping and I try and check out and my credit card is rejected. So I get on the phone and spend 45 minutes running down why it's rejected. It takes me 45 minutes to get through to my credit card company. I'm standing there in Whole Foods. My groceries are getting warm. And they explained to me that it's not me, it's the retailer who's under fraud alert. And so I finally get my groceries, at which point the cashier admits to me that I'm the third person this has happened to in the last hour just on her lane.
Well, you know, the control mechanism has ways of notifying you that you're out of line. But,
right.
You know, that's how you and I would look at it to a certain extent. People would say, yeah,
right.
Okay, sure, that's what, yeah, but you know from as an insider that they have these abilities and you've been the victim of it, had to fight it for 10 years. But what I would
right.
say is, you know, you end up with Whole Foods ultimately adapting a position that says, yeah, we'll deal with labeling and we'll deal with converting, you know, 4 years, 5 years down the line. So they push that away when basically they
right.
can get it done in 6 months if they really wanted to.
And
right. then the second thing is they say, you know, we really need to have a collaborative attitude with the GMO guys because they have
right.
to offer. And then you start hearing people come out and you know, the shills that say, yeah, we should really be looking at genetically modified technologies as part of an organic portfolio.
Right. Right.
You know, and you just have to look at it and go, okay, you know, if you have any understanding of how the real deal works and the mechanisms involved, you have to laugh.
Okay? Well, there's a war going on.
Right. So don't be seduced by any
right.
of that, okay? Nature wouldn't have a salmon reproducing with a tomato. But that's what they do. They take a salmon gene
right.
to make a tomato more red. Or they take a
right.
gene out of a caterpillar to make, you know, something have better shelf life. And so, you know, the possibilities are endless for creating astonishing amount of chaos in life as we know it. Actually fundamentally
right.
changing life on Earth. Take a look at glyphosate, which is, you know, Roundup, which is the most used pesticide, fungicide, what, you know, because it does so much damage. It's every side that you can think of. And this stuff was patented originally as an antibiotic and a mineral chelator. Basically, it absorbs the minerals. It takes them away out of the system. So now you put it on soil, and you put it on in amounts beyond, you know, anything imaginable, and they tell you it doesn't hurt, it's okay, it won't show up in your water, it has no residual effects and all this. That's the PR. It shows up in your water. They're finding out it's destroying your gut bacteria and changing your biology from the inside out. It's totally changed the biology of soils. You are ending up with scores of new kinds of super weeds, you know, which is wonderful
right.
in one sense because you've created a problem now that you've got to solve. It is basically reducing yields now so that now we finally have the evidence that those agroecological, organic, you know, decentralized methods of farming are actually what's producing more food, okay? So
right.
now the whole vision about, yeah, we can produce more doing this, it's actually backfiring. So everything is breaking down because basically the soil is breaking down. The methods we've been using to farm have been destroying the substrate of life. Okay? So basically you have got to find out who is respecting the soil so that they can produce food that has the nutrition you need so that you can thrive. By you, I mean you,
okay.
your associates, your family, your community. And I know from the inside, from people that have been doing studies, you know, and there's very few of these studies done because they don't want the answers. You can get
right.
the funding for studies to get a certain type of an answer. But if you get another type of an answer, as you can see from Scientists Under Attack and many, many other documented things, you know, you don't get too much of a runway. But basically...
Right.
I was talking with people 20 years ago that said, yeah, we were doing studies since the Green Revolution on the nutritional content of food. It's down 40%. Okay, then you say, well, wait a minute, we have an obesity problem. Yeah, how can you not have an obesity problem? I mean, there's lots of other reasons, too. But when you're basically having to eat, you know, 40% more food to get the same nutrition.
Right.
Never mind all the processes and all the crap that they put in and, you know, substituting real fats and real healthy saturated fats for these synthetic stuff. And that's, as much as anything, what these two schools represent is this idea that we know better about how to do things in Mother Nature, and the ultimate solution is synthetic. It's synthetic life. Versus saying, you know, we probably can't do as good a job as nature does, so why don't we figure out a way to support it, to live with it, to coexist, to collaborate. Those are the relationships you need to have that are collaborative, not with
right.
people that are trying to change life on Earth in ways that
right.
nature would never do it.
Right, so let's go back to soil. So soil is really the source of nutrition. Soil, good soil and good seeds. And
with a little help from sun and water.
Right. So it's soil and water. Can the soil on planet Earth be restored?
This concept of we're going to now be smart ecologically and restore ecological systems is a bit flawed.
Right.
Because whenever you do something, you never do one thing to an ecological system. And to a large extent, Western science is based on reductionism figuring out and kind of isolating independent causative factors that you can then manipulate, understand and manipulate. That is not how life systems work. They are incredibly
right.
interdependent. Doing one
right.
thing here affects something over there, you know, the butterfly effect, but in spades. And unless you have a systems approach, but not only that, a systems understanding, you will have unintended consequences that will not be favorable to life. Okay? That's it.
Right.
So I don't need to know a lot about science to know that the whole approach is going to end you up in trouble. If you have a basic sense about how life works on the planet, which is as a interrelated system. Okay? Now, our understanding of the system of life on this Earth is so immature, it's embarrassing. I mean, if you were an alien looking at this thing and saying, yeah, look at these scientists in the white coats, and they think that they actually know how things work. You know, so we're going to come up with a scheme that puts iron ore filings in the ocean so that it will, you know, absorb more CO2. And nobody goes, are you guys insane? I mean, what? And then, yeah, but we got the computer models that will, yeah, sure you do. Okay, sure, right. We're going to let you guys be in charge of the world. So the most you can do is be in charge of your little microcosm. Now, we're up in Montana. I gave, you know, a very, very talented ecologist, forester, a guy an assignment for 2 or 3 years. I said, you know, we have pretty crappy soil up here. You know, the glaciers came through and the gigantic flood came through and wiped out a huge amount of the topsoil. So we got a lot of gravel and rocks. How can we make vital soil in one place in the United States beside the desert that's about as challenging as you can find? And we were able to do it. We were able to do it with a minimal amount of external inputs using agroecological methodologies, which is basically,
right.
you know, listening to the land. Having an
right.
appreciation for what this land in this place is capable of. You know, understanding the natural types of inputs that you can put in that become self-sustaining. And I said to him, you know, out of this I want a definition of soil that makes sense. Because right now I can't find one. What does healthy soil mean? What's the definition of it? And he basically came up with this, functional dependencies that continue to metabolize through time with minimal amount of inputs, which is a great definition of sustainability. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
You have all of these interrelated systems, fungus, bacterial, on and on, that comprise a handful of soil that is one of the most complex things you could imagine in the universe. Okay?
Right.
And then you just have to figure out, okay, what can we do, but as much importantly as anything, what do we not do to make sure
right.
that this thing has the ability to basically continue as a functional dependent system with all these different things metabolizing the various products that the other thing is giving off to make something that can support life. Okay? That's the approach that you need in agriculture. There is no one in the organic, the full-blown organic, you know, high-yield organic industry with that type of mentality, never mind the regular agro-industrial business. That's not their
right.
orientation at all. Okay, so that needs to be your orientation. And the true biodynamic guys, the true organic guys, the true, you know, the true artisan farmers that understand about land, these are the other people that are committed to that life-giving
right.
intentionality. Those are the guys
right.
you need to support.
Right. Right. The biodynamic people are fascinating, and their focus is soil, soil, soil.
Right. And you can say, well, but they got a lot of hocus-pocus involved in all this, and say, okay, but the intentionality is there. And not only that, every time they start doing some studies on this stuff, they find out, jeepers, there really is something to, like, moon phases in agriculture. Or, you know, you
right.
find out that there's this dependency not only on this planet, but on lots of stuff that's outside of this planet that
right.
affects us. And that affects things in a positive way. So I got a lot of respect for those guys, you know, the Rudolf Steiners of the world and lots of these other guys, because they did some stuff that's absolutely amazing. And let me just say one other thing, too, about science, okay? Science is in the business of creating refutable claim. And that's what science is about. There isn't a way in hell that you could say that the biotech industry is interested in creating refutable claims. They're interested in using political economic means of force to basically repress the search for truth. Okay, because otherwise they would be giving their seeds to everybody to do studies on. They'd be financing. When somebody came up and said, you know, we think there could be a problem, like the FDA and USDA scientists said when this whole issue of biotech technology was being introduced. They said, let us tell you the 27,000 ways that this could be bad. Nobody did the studies to refute those guys. All they did was the studies to accept a very narrow interpretation of how it could be good. And not only that, they made sure that they did it over such a short term that there was no way that the bad effects could come. So as soon as somebody like the hero of that documentary, Scientists Under Attack, started to do some long-term studies, you started to see some long-term, very bad effects.
Right.
Now, I think there's 1,500 or now maybe 2,000 studies like that have been done, mostly against headwinds, having to find their own money, you know, getting under attack from the universities and the system when they try to do it. And, you know, just guys that are incredibly courageous, you know, like yourself, like many other people that are really interested in truth winning.
Right. And I would say life winning. So it's a rejection of a synthetic model, not just because the model doesn't work, but because it's anti-life.
Anti-life. And we know it with our heart, our soul, our gut, and everything else. And, you know, you're an incredible realist with an incredible model that informs beyond any other model that I know of about why things are happening, what is likely to happen, right? Because it also predicts pretty well. But yet you have a very big respect for the spiritual. And, you know, your perspective is that is actually what is the strongest force in life in the universe. These native people, these people that did astonishing things, these indigenous people, astonishing things that they found out, that basically large corporations have suppressed, oftentimes they've destroyed, because they want control over it.
Right.
They don't want something competing. Okay. These guys knew stuff. That spiritual orientation gave them. It gave them real knowledge to do stuff in our real world that was amazing. And I'll give you another one example. It's off the side because we're talking about health. You know, Mr. Rife, who you've talked about in the past, came up with this crazy idea about frequencies basically being associated with health, and that you could use certain frequencies of sound in particular to destroy pathogens.
Right.
He was, you know, destroyed, criminalized, and maybe even put in an insane asylum. You know, that's another technique that they love.
That was Reich. Yeah, that was Reich.
Yeah, but this other guy was the same situation.
Right.
I mean, they do it to all these guys that create a problem for the establishment. Okay, so now I'm involved with a project, and I can't go into too many details, where they're basically using frequencies to destroy pathogens. Know this, know that, you know, all these chemicals that they were using that create as many problems as they solve, you know, resistant bacteria, nothing. Okay, but what you find is, if you want to look for the truth, if you go in with a paradigm of, let us try to refute this, as opposed to support that through force, you know, you will find out that a lot of these practices of these indigenous natural people, including some of these weird biodynamics people, well, jeepers.
They work.
There's something to it.
Right. Right. There's a spiritual or electromagnetic reality to the land and to life and to the creation of life and the life-giving process, which is not, which it is cannot be captured in an industrial process.
There is the analogy of soil as a microcosm of all things life that I mentioned. Okay, so you've got an incredible electrodynamic system. I'm talking about electric. I'm talking about
right. The
ability to communicate information that, you know, mycelium and other things create these astonishing networks. So you're destroying that network, that electrical network, that field that is
right. Intimately
attached to all these other fields associated with life in the universe.
Right.
That's what you're doing. You're disrupting those connections. So it's incredibly profound, and you end up with like big profound problems. Not surprising.
Right. It's funny, when I was down in Australia, I was talking with someone who has responsibilities for doing joint ventures on the indigenous land. And I was describing how you create a governance structure which can respect both the visible and the invisible and get them to work well together.
Agroecology is not only about agriculture, it's also about ecology and ecological systems, which includes human systems, which includes social systems. Unless you address
right. The
entire rubric of stuff, you know, people,
right. Animals,
soil, the whole schmear, and come from a place of, I want to try to do what's best for all of the constituents. You know, it's like part of your model. Okay, what are you giving
right. Back
to the system?
I found myself telling everybody they had to get a copy of Lynn McTaggart's book, The Field, and read it. Because it's almost, you know, it's what I found when I was prototyping place-based equity models in the 90s, is that economies, local economies, optimize around knowledge and what I call morphogenic fields. And, you know, they don't optimize around return on investment to equity. They optimize around human living systems. So if you don't understand the science of fields, and you're not looking at a place as a field and a dynamic field, you're just never, and that's why I love equity models for places, because you have to respect and nurture those fields. And part of it somehow is nurturing the soil and the water first and foremost.
I would go a step further and say that soil is one of the foremost examples of an equity system.
Yes. Yes. Yeah, it's got a little bit like oxygen. No soil, no life.
That's right. No life as we know it.
Right.
It might be
so
very
I just
pleasing to the synthesis and the transhumanists, because they
right. Want
to create life as we don't know it, because they think they know better. They have a better vision, and they basically use the appeal of improving life, improving your individual, improving your ability to learn, improving your ability to high jump and, you know, dunk at 12-foot basketballs, and But what? Who's in control of that technology? Who gets to use it? And what is the effect on life as we know it? And we basically have this concept that if we can do it, we should do it. That's one of the major drivers of technology. We've got a smile on our face while we're doing it. And here we are bombarding the world with EMF. We're bombarding the world with chemicals, 100,000 chemicals that didn't even exist, you know, 100 years ago. We're bombarding the world with technologies that change life at its basis, nanotechnologies that changes chemistry at its basis. And then we wonder why the bees are dying.
One of my favorite moments in the Slurry Report was Dr. Gwen Scott when I called her up and to describe how we were going to organize our conversation about the impact physically of chemtrails. And I said to her, I basically described the 10 steps you can take to protect yourself from chemtrails. And she said, oh, well, dear, that's wonderful, but you forgot the most important one. I said, what's that? She said, Grace, if you look at what's been going on, we should all be dead, but we're not. So something else is happening. The field is working overtime to protect us.
Lot to learn. We've been given the opportunity.
So
what are the choices we're going to make?
Before we leave the food ecosystem, I just want to mention, while you're sitting there in Montana working to figure out how to rebuild the soil and how that relates to water, et cetera, you're also grappling with a regulatory system in Agenda 21, which is doing a huge amount to make sure that you can't. So maybe if you could just touch a little bit on what's happening in terms of Agenda 21 and the regulatory system. I've had, you know, we just did a Salier report on Agenda 21, so we don't need to go into it in depth, but it does figure in.
Yeah, if you talk to the regulatory people here, it doesn't exist. They're not influenced by it. And then all you need to do is just, you know, look under the covers a little bit and see how basically all the techniques they're using, documentation they're using, planning devices are coming basically through that channel. But whether it's a water treaty that was just signed with Salish Kootenai that gives them first priority control over all of the waters in the basin that I live in, but also other basins, to regulations from the EPA on your generator and wood stove. So if you're off the grid now, suddenly you have, you know, other problems. To FEMA mechanisms that you know, allow the federal government to take control over all resources, including food, in a national emergency that's not voted on, basically just declared. To the new permitting processes that are required that we didn't used to have here. To, at any point, some of the 100 different NGOs and organizations that are involved with trying to shape the future of this valley here as part of the network of the Rocky Mountains in the Northwest. You know, at any time, using the Endangered Species Act as a hammer, you know, to come down on you and say, well, you can't have agriculture here because basically it's going to attract this animal that, you know, that's endangered, and therefore you could have conflict and so on. So basically Agenda 21 is about defining certain areas in the world that they want to make reserves out of, which means, you know, using the idea that this is for the benefit of the world and for animals and so on, and getting rid of people. Well, I happen to be one of those areas. So I see it in all of its manifestations, different manifestations, and very few people actually understand that evil exists, they're interested in control, and they have a plan.
And they know what they're doing. They're very good. They're very good at it.
Astonishingly good. They're very, very good at marketing.
Right.
So that's okay. What I can say in general. That gives you a little bit of a flavor.
Well, if anyone is curious, go listen to the Agenda 21 Salary Report. Okay, so let's talk about accessing fresh and nutritious food, because there's no doubt once you start Once you start figuring out how you can get really fresh, nutritious food and you completely convert your life to that, it can make enormous difference. So let's start talking about what that means, the different component parts.
Okay. So one of my heroes is this guy, Will Allen, up in Milwaukee. And, you know, here's a guy that basically developed an incredible closed-loop food system in an urban environment with the idea of making fresh, affordable, accessible, available.
Right.
And he's created a system based on vital soils, not hydroponics and so on, which I think can't replace real soils in terms of nutrition. And so you've got to find people like that who you can support, or you've got to create opportunities for people like that to win. And so whether it's doing your own gardening in ways that are agroecologically based, and there's gigantic amounts of information available. You just have to go seek it out, and plenty of examples to learn from. And using, basically permaculture, agroecology, these are the major movements that have provided tremendous amounts of guidance and how to do things right. Basically,
right.
Get the information. So do it yourself. Do it in combination with members in your community, or get together if you're too busy and pay somebody to do it for you. Because in the end, you end up with a quality of food which is unsurpassed, which the supermarket industry, to a large extent, cannot supply for you except randomly, because they haven't made the commitment to do it yet. They haven't made the commitment to support the supply chain the way they need to do it yet. I keep arguing that with them. Hopefully they'll see the light of day here soon. And at a cost which will surprise you. Because right now, to eat right is expensive. Most people can't afford to do it. So you've got to be clever, you've got to be more imaginative, and cheap food ain't cheap if you measure it in any sort of a way that makes sense economically. Just like, you can't continue to use yield, just like you can't continue to use GDP as an indicator of health, financial health.
Right.
Right? Because
right.
You can destroy the world and have higher GDP. Okay?
Right.
You can do the same thing with soil. You can be destroying your soil and getting better yields for a while. But for the long term, it just doesn't work. Okay? So get somebody that understands soil, has intentionality about maintaining soil. Use your heirloom and open pollinator seeds. Grow this stuff in community and grow the stuff that makes sense. Use water and inputs in a way that makes sense and actually helps promote that life that's in the soil. And that's it. Now you've got vital food. Support other people that are doing it in a regional area. And you can find out who these folks are. And learn enough about it so that you can ask the right kind of questions. And hopefully we'll be able to provide some guidance in that, and not only through this introduction, but in much more detail in the series coming up.
So let me bring up CSAs, because I'm always amazed at how many of our subscribers don't know what a CSA is.
Right. So basically you got a farmer who hopefully is doing the right thing, who has decided to grow certain things. You buy shares in that output, and you pay them in advance usually. And then basically you get a portion of that output in a weekly allocation that you can either pick up or gets delivered to a central location, or sometimes even to your house. So you basically have a share in the output of whatever that's going to be. So it's kind of like going to a restaurant where they have, the meal of the day. So you don't get to choose as much as you want, but you basically have a guy who's right there in your neighborhood or region that's producing healthy stuff for you in the season.
And I've had incredible, the people I know who have picked up and done CSA, I've just had incredible feedback from them as to what it's done for their health to switch over to find something.
You have
like
a huge amount of doctors, Catherine, that are taking people off of GMOs, and they are seeing huge health improvements in their patients over a wide range of disorders by basically getting them on real good food and, in particular, eliminating GMOs.
We did two Celeria reports with Jeffrey Smith, who I know you're a big supporter of, and we go through that in detail. But I want to drill down into this issue because this is where I've had the most baffling experiences over the last 15 years. So when I started doing investment advisory work, Harry, what I would get is a client who had, you know, several million dollars at least in brokerage systems who would tell me they couldn't afford organic food. And I would say to them, are you crazy? If you look at your number one financial risk, it's health. And if you're not healthy, then, you know, you're not going to be alive, but you're going to spend a fortune on doctors. You're going to spend a fortune on healthcare insurance. You're going to, you know, so they're spending $1,000 a month on healthcare insurance, and they're trying crazily to generate yield from all sorts of financial risks they're taking. And meantime, they're eating crappy food, which means they're absolutely going to get sick, and it's going to cost them a fortune.
The way that I would summarize it is like this. You know, we may not know enough to make a claim that a specific way of eating will guarantee health. But one thing we know for sure is that a specific way of eating will absolutely guarantee lack of health.
Right.
Okay, now, we disagree. There are people that disagree about what that should be. The Department of Agriculture has a food pyramid, which to me is not optimal for health. But we are now starting to understand that trans fats, which never should have happened in the first place, which are a product of the AMA basically telling you, based on stupid interpretations of very limited studies, again, that, you know, saturated fats like butter and so on are bad for you. So let's invent a whole industry of trans fats, based oils and so on that are more healthy for you, that 30 years later they finally admit, yeah, that's what was killing you. So, you know, for me, the Weston Price Organization and their approach towards food, the way that they validated it, is one of the best models for how you should eat. But in the end, nobody should tell you how to eat. You should tell yourself how to eat. But one of the most important things to do first is to get yourself clean, just like you've advised in terms of getting yourself clean when, as you approach your finances and other aspects of life. Okay?
Right.
So get yourself on the purest food you can so you can think properly, so your body can now give you feedback, because that's what life is about, these interrelated feedback mechanisms, that you need to listen to, which is what agroecology is about, listen to the land. So get yourself in a place where you can communicate in a way that provides coherence, clarity about what you need, okay, and then listen. Because then when you go into the supermarket, you go into your refrigerator or anywhere, you're going to have this mechanism, this built-in mechanism, this field right at your disposal that's going to be able to tell you, I need this, I need that, I need that as a hunter-gatherer to maximize my health. But to begin with, if the ingredients themselves are compromised, you can never win. And you just need to understand that 95% or so of the ingredients in a typical supermarket are compromised.
Okay, now I want to dive into a couple stories here because I believe that the consumer, both as consumer and investor, can absolutely transform the planet just by insisting on what they need to be healthy. But it's not happening. I've spent a lot of time trying to get it to happen. So I want to talk about one of the obstacles and start with a story or two stories. I was sitting... I haven't, as you know, the only thing I ever do in junk food restaurants is go to the bathroom and occasionally buy coffee. But I was sitting in, I had a little house next to me that I owned and was renting. And the tenants had the family had a birthday party for one of the kids. And they had a ton of fast food restaurant food sitting on the kitchen table. And the grandmother was sitting at the kitchen table not eating the food from the fast food restaurant. So I wasn't eating it either. So I said to her, how come you're not eating the fast food food? And she said, oh, I used to work at an auction house. And this is probably arguably the number one fast food restaurant in the country. she said, I used to work at an auction house. I said, really? And she said, yeah, we used to separate out the cancerous and diseased animals so that the fast food restaurant could get them cheap.
Pepsi bragged about the fact, this was years ago when they were owning Taco Bell and so on, that their food costs were 12% or 13%. You know, in other words, they go to investors and they get applauded. Yay! For a real good restaurant that cares about food and preparation is trying to do the right job, you know, food costs is 30 to 35%.
Right. So, but here's the thing. The grandmother was sitting there while her grandkids were eating it.
I know, but what is she going to tell them? And what are they going to believe? You know?
Right. So let me go to the next story. So I finally got one of my neighbors to watch the Super Size Me, which is the documentary. I should mention we have several lists of documentaries in the subscriber links to this Salaire Report, and they're great documentaries. Anyway, but Super Size Me, about the documentary maker who decided he would only eat at McDonald's for 30 days. And she came over after it took me years to get her to watch. It was, you know, it was a real war. And she finally watched it. She came over and she said, oh, my God, you know, I can't, I got to stop feeding my kids at McDonald's. And or her grand, it was her grandkids. I said, exactly right. It's very, very important. And this is somebody who really cares about taking care of their kids and grandkids. So a couple weeks later, I was driving the grandkids. We were going to see the museum in Memphis. And she came over and she said, you know, they're really hungry. Why don't you stop at McDonald's and get something on the way? And literally she had forgotten. She had forgotten in a matter of several weeks. And I later challenged her on it. And she basically, these are my words, not hers. Basically what she said is, look, you are capable of holding a framework outside of popular opinion, but I can't. In other words, I am intellectually incapable of maintaining a separate field from the popular field.
Okay, so this is the reality as far as I understand it, and I think you can find verification of it everywhere. You got to come to grips with this fact that we're not going to succeed as humans on this planet unless we get rid of our victim mentality and we take responsibility for our behavior. Second thing is, the system has failed you. The system is working for the guys that are benefiting from it. It works. See, this is one of the major things you've taught me. It's working.
Right. The system is successful.
The central banking warfare model is working for those guys. It's not working for the world, but it works.
Well, here's the thing. You're much easier to harvest if you're weak and addicted.
Right. But the system has failed you. So if you're going to rely on the FDA and the USDA and the agricultural system and your local supermarket, sorry, guys, I keep trying to educate the industry about what they can do to create truly differentiated competitive advantage. Sometimes I get a few people to listen occasionally, and we make some good progress, but I'm not giving up. Okay, so it's failed you. So now you can't be a victim anymore. You've got to be responsible if you want to be healthy, because otherwise other people have other plans for you.
Right. So I want to tell another story and then bring it back to the point I'm trying to make here. During the same period, I got a knock on the door, and it was a neighbor who I'd never met, heard about for years, but never met. And he said, you know, I hear you have a second freezer that you might be available for sale. He said, my kids are now growing our food for the family, and we need an extra freezer. So my freezer wasn't for sale, but I was glad to meet him, and we started to talk. And he looked at me, and he said, you know, it's not safe to buy the food you get in the grocery store. He said, you know, they're killing us. And I said, yeah, I know. Now, here's the reality. For whatever reason, he could maintain, you know, knowledge outside the popular opinion field, you know, and the other neighbor couldn't. But the reality is, right now, if you want to take responsibility and you want to do something about your food, then you're going to have to find the people who are willing to leave the popular opinion field and not worry about the rest. So that sounds like a cruel and ruthless thing to say, but what I've found is you can spend a lifetime trying to persuade the folks eating at McDonald's that they need to do this, and you're not going to get anywhere. Where you are going to get someplace is when you team up or you support a guy like Will Allen, and you simply do the best you can with the people who are ready to go. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. And then the individual has got to make a decision. Am I going to prioritize what's going into my body 3, 4, 10 times a day as
right.
more important than something else? That's it. They've got to make a choice. And then they got to figure out, okay, what does that mean? You know, I think ultimately what it means is that more people are going to be spending time in agriculture than less.
Right.
Okay. And, but then, so then if you don't want to do it, you got to find people that will do it, and you got to support them. And you got to say, well, this may be more expensive, it may be a little bit more inconvenient for a while, but the consequences of not doing it is really more expensive and really more inconvenient. Never mind even about the ecology, about me, for me, my family, what I want to do.
Right.
So that's it. It's basically a question of prioritizing resources, and one of the most important resources is your time and intentionality. Okay, and you got to put it towards this. Now, what I would say is, see, I don't agree that you're going against the popular opinion, because everybody wants food they can trust that's wholesome and nutritious, and it tastes good. Everybody wants that. That's the popular opinion. The problem is the noise, and then also convincing you that this is actually that when it's not. So
right.
I keep telling supermarkets, the biggest thing that you sell is trust. They've broken that trust.
Right.
And so you got to be associated with people you can trust, that produce food that you can trust, that actually gives you what you need to get through this very, very challenging life with all its headwinds.
Right.
And part of the headwinds is that noise. That's trying to convince
right.
you that this is good for you when it's not. It's not good for you. As an individual.
The pro-centralization team has amazing propaganda on what's good for you. So let me bring this down to one of the most interesting conversations I've had in the in 2016 so far. And that is when you sit with people looking at the future, what you realize is there's tremendous fear in the leadership about what's going to happen as robotics and new technology basically, you know, devastate further global incomes and employment. So if suddenly corporations can do everything with robots and people aren't needed to do things other than, you know, the small business that hasn't been wiped out yet, what exactly is it people are going to do? And there's lots of conversation about guaranteed income. So Canada is considering a guaranteed income. I forget which country in Scandinavia is now legislated a guaranteed income, but the theory being that people aren't needed to do work. So on one hand, we have leadership saying, you know, we've got to double the food production, so we need more industrial agriculture because we need to be more productive. But meantime, oh my God, there's nothing for all these people to do, which tells me that we have a multiple personality disorder when it comes to what is productive about using labor in agriculture. So let me say it another way. I live next to what used to be a dairy farm, which was put out of business, not by the market, but by food safety rules. And if you look at how much we're paying people not to work and be on food stamps or welfare or unemployment compensation, there is no doubt in my mind that, you know, allowing small dairy farms to market directly to their neighbors is a lot more economic for the U.S. economy than these food safety rules and sort of, you know, highly centralized dairies, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So this idea that you can't take all this labor, which is freed up, and make it feasible for them to do small-scale farming. Small-scale farming would be unbelievably economic when you look at the full system ecosystem and the extent to which government debt is basically financing all of these externalities created by agriculture, by industrialized agriculture.
Well,
so maybe if you could talk a little bit about real efficiencies.
This is what I would say. This is what I would say, because you and I go back and forth on this. Because what you're saying is jeepers. Just think, if government was run right about, and they made the right policy decisions, if the right policies were there, how much of a thriving world we could have, okay? So I've given up on all that. In other words, this is not, you can't rely on policy, because all that policy has done is like the agricultural business. Soil gives you the answer. If you put an input in that's going to make the bacteria win over the fungus, or destroy this bacteria versus that, you're going to create chaos. You're going to create a system which is not sustainable. And that's what policy does, because it's driven basically by moneyed interests, you know, by control files and all these other things that I tried to educate us about, okay? So you've got to come up with a solution based on as close to you, your family, people you can trust in the community, which is the foundation of this kind of whole Solari circle concept. I'm sorry, you're going to have to create a conspiracy among like-minded people in a Solari circle type of framework locally. And then you need to protect yourself and come up with a fund to cushion yourself against the headwinds you're going to go up against, the regulators that are going to come in and try to mess with you if you create enough of a problem, or just because that's what they have to do to justify their existence, or there is actually a mandate from up high that says, you know, when this guy comes out with this study, you need to fire him. You know, a call from the United States president to the prime minister of England to fire this guy, you know, in the scientist under attack thing, because he basically started to show some real scientific evidence that GMOs could kill your ass. Okay, so you just have to be prepared for that. So, you know, get together, make the decision to begin with, that you're going to make food a priority. Have the right idea of what food is, and in a few other sessions we'll talk about what a definition of food is, right? That makes sense. Get with people that have the same type of intentionality, same type of like-mindedness. Find a way for you guys to do it yourself, or hire somebody to create those local solutions. As a matter of policy, those inputs are as poisonous from the government as those other agricultural inputs from the industry to the soil of life, which is equivalent to your community of life, your community. Right. That's the way that I can answer it.
Right, and if you look at all the different steps you can take to start to educate yourself or establish a really non-synthetic fresh food supply for yourself, doing that, I think, is arguably one of the most important things you can do to transforming what's happening politically and economically here on planet Earth. In other words,
that's why I call it a lever. It's one of the major levers for freedom, for human freedom.
Right. Right. So if we each just do what we need to do to have a fresh food supply that ensures our or supports our good health, and we organize to help others interested in doing the same in our local area, you know, it changes everything. And in fact, I would like to point out that Monsanto just got a takeover proposal because they're in deep trouble. And we have a whole series of American corporations coming out and saying they're walking away from GMO or labeling, which, if you look what they've been trying to do, is astonishing. And that's the consumer just refusing to play.
Yeah, Jeffrey Smith would tell you that he feels that a tipping point has been accomplished. And then also I would, you know, say cynically that, yep, those GMO technologies are going back to its source, you know, the Third Reich, with the German company giving a bid for Monsanto. So I'm sorry, guys. I once believed in a world where those in charge really cared about the individuals that they are supposed to be serving and are accountable to. That world doesn't exist. Sorry.
Right.
And so you better take responsibility in for yourself and your own welfare. You better do it with people, like-minded people, that can turbocharge that effort and give you protection. And spend time with people like Catherine Fitz, you know, who gives you incredible insights into the real deal and ways to navigate the headwinds that are produced by folks that have a different plan, that are into control, that are into centralization.
So before we close, I just want to walk through a list of some of the things that people can do between now and the next Solari Food series. One is you've provided a list of documentaries, and we have several lists of documentaries, and I put them in the subscriber list. But they're one way to start the conversation locally is to get people together and start watching some of these documentaries, or just get your family to start watching them and understand how important it is. That's number one. Two, find the information sources on the local farmers and food. Ideally, you can find a CSA, a really good CSA in your area. I know you mentioned Weston Price, and Weston Price has local chapters all over the country, and they're also a great way of finding information. And I think they've gone beyond North America, in fact. And then just find the sources of good organic food. There are grocers who do good organic food. And if you're lucky enough to be where their farmer markets, just familiarize yourself with the farmer's markets and get down on them. And then the other thing is gardening. See if you can't find other people who are interested in gardening, or start gardening yourself, or at least if you look at how much money gets spent on landscaping, Harry, I always just despair. If we try to make our landscapes edible, it's amazing how much food we could produce. There's always a quote that you hear during World War II when the Liberty Gardens started, that within 2 years they were producing 40% of the fruits and vegetables. Is that true?
Yeah, I think in some cases it was more than that.
Wow.
You know, look at even Cuba. When they basically got cut off from the world, they basically had to invent from scratch, using oftentimes these guys that were professors and so on, white collar guys that had no farming experience, but ended up had to figure things out real fast. You know, an agroecological system through the entire country.
Right.
Because they couldn't get the chemicals, they couldn't get the seeds, they couldn't get subsidy, they couldn't get all this other stuff. So there was an example of a whole country that did it, and they did it almost overnight. And they went through some pretty rough times, but they basically ended up with a food supply that, compared to most others, was much more vital than most of the countries on Earth. And even in
right, and they ended up with a whole world of organic farmers who had, relative to the population, very high incomes.
That's right. They became some of the most important people in society.
Right.
So there's a way, like anything else, you've got to have a commitment, you've got to set priorities, you've got to make intelligent choices, because choices are being made for us that are not pro-life, in my opinion. And there's another plan. When you go take a look at the transhumanists and these guys that believe in the synthetic way, they just have another plan. And it's unraveling very, very quickly, the web of life that exists as we have known it for 4 billion years on this planet.
Right, and it's much more nuts than you think. Okay, what's next on the Solari Food series, Harry? What are you going to do first?
Well, there's a lot of individuals that I know that are some of the foremost experts in their field, and rather than name names, I don't want to do that at this point. But what I would tell you is we're going to talk about soil in more depth. We're going to talk about use of terms like natural and organic and so on in more depth. We're going to talk about pasture-raised animals and grass-fed. One of the best experts in the world is a personal friend of mine. Maybe we can bring in scientists like Altieri, who started the whole agroecological movement, who I've had interactions with over the years, or Don Huber, who knows a huge amount about glyphosate and how it's damaging the system. And then chefs that are my kind of guys that are doing remarkable things with food, and local farmers and so on. So there's a huge, rich network of folks that I can draw on, and hopefully people will find what we have to say interesting.
We will. Well, Harry, I can't thank you enough for joining us on the Salieri Report. This has been fascinating, and food is emerging at the very heart of the
the struggle.
Trying to find a way not to use war. But, it really comes down to life. So food is at the heart of deciding how we celebrate life here on the planet. And nobody inspires me more than you on this topic. So I can't thank you enough for joining us on the Salieri Report. And we can't wait to the next to the next one in the Salieri Food Series. So you have a great day, Harry.
Thank you, buddy. And I'll put on a bunch of links that go along with this that will get people going and point in the right direction.
Perfect. Okay, we'll post everything in the subscribers link. So if you're listening, you want to make sure you log into the commentary on this Salieri Report and log into the website and look at those subscriber links. All right, you have a great day.